I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, if yesterday was Tuesday, it must have been Wisconsin.
The motto of the state of Wisconsin is forward. And I want to thank the state of Wisconsin for moving this cause and this campaign forward tonight here in this great state. I thank you so much.
Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, of course, who won last night's Democratic primary in Wisconsin, but finishing only 6 points behind after a last-minute surge, the second-place finisher was Senator John Edwards of North Carolina, who could also claim success.
No, the people of Wisconsin spoke loudly and clearly today. They want a debate. They want this campaign to continue. They want some.
And continue it will, but not perhaps for everyone. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean placed a distant third last night. He's due to address his supporters today in Burlington, Vermont. Reports say his campaign is effectively finished. Yet Dean, too, was claiming a victory of sorts last night.
You have already written the platform of the Democratic Party for this election. A year ago, the Democrats were falling all over each other to vote for the war in Iraq. They sure don't talk like that now. A year ago, the Democrats were accepting reckless budget deficits and huge tax cuts that mortgage our children's futures. They don't talk like that anymore.
Well, we're joined now from Burlington, Vermont, by the managing editor of the Burlington Free Press, Jeff Gevalt. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Jeff, what's the buzz around Burlington about what Howard Dean is going to say today?
I think the feeling is that Howard is going to hang on in some fashion, that he will step away from the campaign, but that he will try to keep his influence somehow intact. I think the feeling is that he's got a lot of committed and very generous supporters, and that they deserve to have their voice to be continued to be heard. There are a couple of ideas that are being thrown about as to whether he forms some kind of a political action committee that helps in the campaign, kind of goes out and talks about Bush, maybe helps with the congressional campaigns and even some of the state races. That's one idea, and I'm not sure that the Dean campaign has fully formulated exactly what it's going to do.
Looking back, and I hate to bring it up, but you contrast the speech he gave last night, an excerpt of which we just heard, to the famous Scream speech. Would it have changed the landscape if the speech he gave last night were the speech he gave after his first loss in Iowa?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I personally think that the Scream speech, or I Have a Scream as it was dubbed, did him some damage and really hurt his chances of getting a good rebound into New Hampshire. It distracted people, and I think it really focused people's concerns about whether Howard Dean would be a viable and strong candidate against George Bush.
Jeff, he told his supporters last night that they'd change the race and change the politics and policies of the Democratic Party. What do you think?
Oh, I think he definitely has had an impact. He referred to it as, I've put some spine into the Democratic Party. I think in fairness to him, I think he did. He focused on Iraq at the start. And that was an issue that all the Democratic candidates were tiptoeing around. And he basically said, I oppose it. I don't think we should do it. I don't think we should be there once we did get there. And he kept on it. And he really excited some people who in some ways were disenfranchised, not necessarily that active, who said, yeah, doggone it, that's how I feel. Mm-hmm. I think what he did was he showed that, A, you can excite a campaign, you can get some attention, and you can get some money.
Jeff Gevalt, the managing editor of the Burlington Free Press. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
A federal prosecutor in a major terrorism case in Detroit is suing Attorney General John Ashcroft and the Justice Department. Assistant U.S. Attorney Richard Convertino says the Justice Department interfered with his terrorism case, compromised a confidential informant, and exaggerated results in the war on terror. Well, joining us from New York is Matt Fleischer Black. He's senior reporter for American Lawyer Magazine. And Matt, could you first briefly, without the details, remind us, what case is Convertino claiming the Justice Department interfered with?
It was a trial early last year, and it involved various official local Detroit area folks who mm-hmm. had were accused of collaboration with terrorists. Mm-hmm.
Well, Convertino says Ashcroft's department interfered with the case to the extent that they insinuated themselves into the trial, I'm quoting, to justify their existence.
The main accusation against them is, or the main complaints about the prosecutor's behavior was that they had withheld documents, went too far, and didn't serve justice.
And this is the Justice Department's complaint, or?
That was the defense lawyer's complaint, and then it was the then there was an investigation opened up by the Justice Department mm-hmm. of Convertino, and that's believed to be what the focus of that investigation is. That's not clear from either Convertino's complaint or the press reports that have come out about it.
It is very complicated. Convertino, again, says that the Justice Department placed perception over reality in the assessment of the war on terror. He was very critical of them on that. And he says that they, the Justice Department, leaked the name of one of his informants.
A tremendous thing to do. If true, very juvenile behavior by the Department of Justice and potentially damaging. Convertino obviously has taken that very hard and feels like it has undermined the root of being a prosecutor.
To the extent that he testified before a Senate committee complaining about the Justice Department, and that's when the investigation of him by the Justice Department was launched, he says, in retaliation. Where does the case stand now?
Convertino's case?
Yes.
It's just been filed. It's just getting started. It will work its way through the system. And it could take a good year before anything substantial really happens with it. We'll see if the judge leaps on this. Occasionally, judges will try and push a case forward. But even national security cases so far have taken a year, 2 years, like the John Walker Lind case.
Well, Matt, the Justice Department has not commented on this case. But how extraordinary is it that a federal prosecutor would sue the Attorney General and the Justice Department?
Oh, my. Unusual. Unheard of, practically. There are a couple of other instances where FBI agents have sued the Department of Justice, their supervising agency in which the FBI sits. They usually they file employment suits. They say that they've been harassed or their promotion has been blocked. That's not what Convertino has done here. So his mm-hmm. approach is fairly distinctive, as far as I know. It's the first in recent modern history.
Well, and one that we will continue to watch. Matt, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Matt Fleischer Black is senior reporter for American Lawyer magazine.
A young, single mother with children is convicted of small-time drug dealing, and under federal minimum sentencing guidelines, she must be sent to prison for decades. Such sentences have been required now since the 1980s, but judges had some discretion to modify punishments they considered too extreme. They lost that last summer when Congress passed the Feeney Amendment, legislation that mandated that judges stick to sentencing guidelines. Well, now there's a gathering tide of revolt. Two federal judges have resigned over the new rule. The American Bar Association's condemned it, too. We're joined now by Judge Robert Sindrich, who resigned this month as district judge for Western Pennsylvania. He joins us from Pittsburgh. Welcome, Judge Sindrich.
Thank you, Bill.
Judge, so the Feeney Amendment, sponsored by a Republican congressman from Florida, Tom Feeney, making mandatory sentencing guidelines more mandatory than ever. Why did you come to a point where you resigned over it?
Well, I resigned in part over the Feeney legislation. I thought that it was not only a sign of disrespect and disregard for the judiciary, but one that interfered with the Sixth Amendment right to have one's case heard by judge.
Around the same time you resigned, another judge in Brooklyn, senior U.S. District Judge Jack Weinstein, declared he will now videotape all his sentencing hearings. Why do you think he's doing that?
I think he's absolutely correct. That is because if the Congress wants the appellate body, which, understand, doesn't have the defendant or his family or the victims or anybody before them, they look at a cold record. If they want them to do the sentencing, then at least we ought to humanize it in some small measure by having them actually see and hear the people who are involved.
You use the word humanize. What is dehumanizing? And I think you've used those words about Feeney.
I have, and it's not just Feeney. It's the entire sentencing guideline structure coupled with mandatory minimum sentences. The dehumanizing part is that we have a formula. And that formula gets applied no matter what. And usually the formula results in poor people, those most likely to be caught, notice I said caught, selling drugs, being sentenced to long terms of imprisonment. It's also dehumanizing, Bill, because there's no compassion in it. We read from this regulatory scheme that's been created by the Congress, and the defendant looks up at us with uncomprehending eyes, at the end of which we say, and off to jail, take him for 25 years. That's dehumanizing.
Yeah. And, Judge, this is not about kind of soft-hearted judges, is it? John Martin, the judge from the Southern District of New York who resigned over this, was known as something of a hanging judge, a very, very tough sentencer. But he, too, found Feeney impossible to live with.
Yes, it really crosses all political boundaries. Every judge that I know is offended by it.
A lot of opposition to this, as we pointed out. Is there any chance that Feeney can be changed?
In the prevailing political climate, I doubt it, because the congressman or senator who wants to remove that Feeney amendment will be attacked by unscrupulous opponents as being, quote, soft on crime, quote, and that's a death knell.
This must have been a very difficult decision for you to make, to resign from the bench.
It was a heart-wrenching decision. I loved that job. I thought I was doing pretty well at it, and I had planned to be there for the rest of my life. But I will not do anything with the balance of my life that I consider wrongful, and certainly nothing that I consider wrongful as directed against the poorest and most helpless among us.
Judge Robert Sindrich, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Bill.
Judge Robert Sindrich was, until his resignation, U.S. District Judge in Pittsburgh.
Just ahead, in light of the avian flu outbreak in Asia and in some chickens in Delaware, we look back at the deadly influenza plague of 1918.
And later in the show, the gasoline additive MTBE was supposed to be phased out because of groundwater contamination. The Bush administration has decided to shelve that plan.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
2 4-year-old boys died of avian flu today, one in Thailand and one in Vietnam, bringing to 22 the number of deaths in Asia from the disease. 80 million chickens have been slaughtered to try to stop the spread of avian flu. It has not so far been a major problem in this country. Outbreaks of the virus in chickens in Delaware and New Jersey earlier this month appear to have been contained. But beware of complacency, say World Health officials, particularly considering the subject of our next conversation, the flu of 1918, which killed as many as 40 million people worldwide. We're joined now by John Barry. He's author of the new book, The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history. He joins us from his home in New Orleans. Hi, John.
Thank you very much.
John, to give our listeners a sense of the nightmarish proportions this epidemic reached, before we get to causes and whether it could happen again and all the questions we want to ask, recount for us, if you would, what happened in 1918 on a streetcar in Cape Town, South Africa.
Well, one gentleman got on the car and people started dying. I think there were 3 deaths on the streetcar. The driver of the car died. The car stopped. He got off and walked home. people could die that suddenly.
Yeah, yeah. People just fell over dead. In 24 weeks, this epidemic killed more people than AIDS has killed in 24 years.
That's correct. The most, according to a Nobel laureate, the most likely death toll was 50 million and possibly considerably more than that. And that number has been confirmed by more recent epidemiological research. In the U.S., it killed about 675,000.
In terms of the population of the planet today, it would be equivalent to 175 to 325 million people. What caused it, John?
Well, it was a lethal virus that crossed over from birds to man. The best evidence suggests that that actually happened in southwest Kansas, and a draftee carried the virus to Fort Riley, what is now Fort Riley, and from there it spread around the world.
Crossed over from birds to men. Now, how does that happen? Someone eats the bird or it goes through the air?
No, all influenza viruses, their natural home is birds. And if you're exposed to chickens, and it's an intestinal virus, so their feces and so forth, you breathe it in and it can happen. Then the virus can either mutate, or if a person has a human influenza virus, the two viruses can create a new hybrid that will pass from person to person. The same thing can happen in pigs and other animals as well, that virus could go from birds to pigs to people. And it happened three times in the 20th century. 1918 was a lethal pandemic, but there were others in 1957 that was nowhere near as bad, but pretty serious. 1968 was a non-lethal virus. It made many, many people sick, but it killed very few.
Now, in 1918, people started to get sick. No one had any idea what was happening, right?
That's correct. I mean, they were familiar with influenza.
Sure.
But this was an entirely different entity. No one had ever seen anything like it. People would bleed not only from their nose and mouth, but from their eyes and ears. Most people had a normal influenza attack, but there was a minority, and it was not a tiny minority, that got this really serious disease. And science was actually quite modern. They were fully scientific and some great people working on this stuff. And they addressed the disease and were overwhelmed by it in the short period of time that it moved through the population, and yet some great science came out of it. It was really the first collision between modern medicine and epidemic disease.
So it would be a mistake to think, well, this flu was so virulent and deadly because it was way back in 1918 when they couldn't cope with it as well as we could now.
Well, unfortunately, we haven't made tremendous progress on influenza except in the level of vaccines. I mean, there are some drugs that can limit the severity, but the most effective thing we can do is vaccinate. However, when you get a new virus that starts spreading around the world, you have a deadly race between finding a vaccine, producing it, and distributing it. If you can do that, you have to keep that ahead of the movement of the virus, and it would be a very difficult race to win today as well.
Yeah, John, you say a new virus. Now, the ultimate question, could it happen again, and where does a new virus come from?
Well, all influenza viruses are in birds, and when a new one crosses over into man, it becomes very dangerous. And
it kind of mutates into a whole new kind of virus?
Well, it is a different virus. Huh. I mean, when a bird virus moves to man, then people's immune systems have not seen it before, and therefore it can spread very rapidly. And, you know, it can either be a hybrid virus joining with an existing human influenza virus, or the bird virus can simply mutate in a manner that allows it to pass from person to person.
So could it happen again? We see now in Asia a number of people have died from a new avian flu. Could that become a pandemic like 1918?
If that virus does adapt to people so that it can pass from person to person, it has the possibility of being a truly deadly organism, far worse than AIDS, frankly. And governments need to take that seriously. One of the lessons of 1918 is that the governments need to tell the truth and act immediately. In Asia right now, because of the economics of the situation, we have a similar situation. countries are lying to protect farmers or farmers are not telling the truth. And the truth matters because in this case, not telling the truth and not acting immediately can have very serious consequences.
Just to finish up, John, how do you know when it's a pandemic? Does it just reach a point where so many people are dying that it's declared such, or is there a way to know earlier on so that you can deal with earlier on what's going to become a pandemic?
The World Health Organization does have a monitoring system worldwide, although it's not complete. It has many gaps. But if they identify a new virus that has adapted to man, that's serious. As of right now, the avian influenza has not adapted to man. People who've gotten sick have had massive exposures directly to the virus in chickens. As soon as it adapts, then the situation is very serious.
John Barry is author of the new book, The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Bush administration has shelved a move to ban the gasoline additive MTBE. The 1992 Clean Air Act required additives in gas to help clean the air, MTBE being the chemical of choice for most manufacturers. It's since been found to pollute drinking water. Critics accuse the administration of pandering to donors. Three of MTBE's producers were major contributors to President George W. Bush's campaign. Joining us on the line is Santa Monica, California Assistant City Attorney Joseph Lawrence. Santa Monica is ground zero in the discovery of MTBE in groundwater. It was found there in 1996. And Joe, tell us, what is the status of MTBE in Santa Monica's water today?
Santa Monica still has a high amount of MTBE in its groundwater, in its aquifer, its primary aquifer, and we've been unable to use the drinking water for about 8 years now. So about half of the city's drinking water is basically off limits and cannot be used by the public right now. And as a result, the city has to buy water from other sources to the tune of about $3 million a year.
Now, as you well know, the Environmental Protection Agency favors a phase out of MTBE through legislation. But as we've said, that legislation is stalled. It no longer calls for a ban. Your thoughts, first of all, on sort of the shelving of this ban?
Well, Santa Monica early on took the position that only so many canaries should have to die in the coal mine, and that Santa Monica's problems were enough for Santa Monica to be a wake-up call to everybody else. From the city's point of view, it is very disturbing that the federal government has yet to move nationwide on eliminating MTBE. The chemical has proven to be more of a hazard than people first realized, and it's time to just move on and come up with other solutions.
Well, 17 states followed California's lead, and they have banned it. But what about legal avenues? You have sued oil companies?
That lawsuit settled against many of the companies in late 2003, with those companies agreeing to pay for and fund a water treatment plant that would clean up the MTBE. Then, in addition, the companies agreed to pay the city a substantial cash payment.
Well, what do you say to some of these companies who say that they're a victim of Washington's failures, that they were required to add MTBE before it was even tested, and that it, in fact, did exactly what it was designed to do, which was clean the air?
The oil companies knew back in the early 1980s that MTBE posed a serious threat to groundwater if it was added to gasoline and then it escaped from an underground storage tank, for instance. And they had options, as the US EPA has noted for many years now. While oil companies were required to use what are called oxygenates, which MTBE is a oxygenate. Mm-hmm. The federal legislation did not require them to use MTBE. The companies found it easier, for one reason or another, for economic reasons of their own, to use MTBE. And so, on the one hand, they knew quite well the risks. They avoided taking steps that would protect against the risks. And they chose to do what they chose to do with their eyes wide open.
Well, obviously, you and Santa Monica are concerned and also concerned about the rest of the country. But as we've said, this has been quietly shelled. What other options do you have to put it on a front burner?
Well, I think that many people are refusing to let it be, in fact, put on the back burner. And there have been many elected officials, both in California and elsewhere, who have made it an important issue.
Any chance that this is going to become an election year issue?
It certainly is an election year issue. People are organizing around it on many different levels, and so it remains very much an important aspect of the nation's energy debate.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Joseph Lawrence, Assistant City Attorney of Santa Monica, California.
The roar of snowmobiles in Yellowstone Park has environmentalists screaming foul at National Park Service officials. At issue is a new Park Service decision allowing 780 snowmobiles into the park this winter, despite a federal court ruling limiting the number to 493. The Park Service says it based its decision on a different federal ruling, which had ordered officials not to impose a Clinton administration plan to ban snowmobiles entirely starting next winter. Well, to help us sort all this out, we're joined now by Scott McMillian, the environmental reporter with the Bozeman Daily Chronicle in Bozeman, Montana. And Scott, we have a U.S. district judge threatening to hold National Park Service officials in contempt for violating his order to limit the number of snowmobiles to 493. Can you explain how Park Service officials decided to go ahead and increase the number?
Well, it's about a 50% doubling of the capacity, and that's based on an order from a federal judge of equal stature in Wyoming. There have been conflicting federal rulings, and the Park Service is trying to figure out what to do. The judge in Wyoming, Clarence Brimmer, ordered the Park Service to come up with a plan that the judge said would be fair to everyone. The Park Service decided to increase the cap on snowmobiles allowed into the park.
So when there are two federal court decisions like this on the same subject, which supersedes which, or does there have to be a whole new court decision to sort that out?
I think there's going to have to be a new court decision. There are two separate appellate courts. One appeals court or the other could yield jurisdiction.
In any event, the extra snowmobiles seem to now be permitted in Yellowstone National Park, right?
Yes, they're permitted, but they haven't arrived. The previous cap of about 480 sleds a day had not been met. Entrances into the park are down 60% in January compared to last January. There's so much confusion over whether the park is open that traffic is way down anyway.
One generally thinks, Scott, I think, of Park Service officials as environmentalists. What's the argument in favor of additional snowmobiles?
Money. People make a lot of money catering to tourists who like to snowmobile in the park. That's the main argument. That was the argument that Judge Clarence Brimmer cited in Wyoming. And I think most Park Service people try very hard to take good care of the park, but they're also federal government employees. Ultimately, they report to the Secretary of Interior's office. Both judges, the judge in Washington and the judge in Wyoming, have criticized political interference from Interior Department, although from different administrations. The Wyoming judge criticized the Clinton administration's political interference. The Washington, D.C. judge criticized the Bush administration's political interference. The Park Service and some of the people who live near the park, I think, are starting to feel like the bone in the middle of a dogfight.
What are environmentalists saying about all this? It's such a vast park, an argument could be made, that 500 snowmobiles, even 1,000 snowmobiles, how much difference does it make?
Oh, I think it makes a lot of difference, uh-huh. And it also depends on what type of snowmobile. And the old four-stroke snowmobiles are very heavy, polluting vehicles. Mm. The new ones are much
cleaner and considerably quieter. Now, whether they are clean enough and quiet enough for a place as pristine as Yellowstone is a legal and value judgment. And I think that's what's going to be decided by whatever court takes this up in the future.
Scott McMillian is the environmental reporter with the Bozeman Daily Chronicle in Bozeman, Montana. Scott, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Still to come, the popular Atkins diet has some people avoiding pasta. We'll talk to a doctor who says, hey, pasta's good for you.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Here and Now. The worst humanitarian crisis in the Western Hemisphere is in Colombia, where as many as 3 million people are refugees. The only places in the world where the humanitarian situation is more grave, human rights experts say, are the Congo and Sudan. Joining us on the line is Assistant UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Kamal Morjane. Welcome, Mr. Morjane.
Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Morjane, one reason we're doing this story is because how few of us understand what's happening in Colombia or get much news about it. Let's review the situation there. Right now, for example, is there daily fighting between the Colombian armed forces and guerrilla groups?
I think the situation has been the same for more than four decades now. And it's clear that all this period of time, a lot of people has to leave their places of origin and be displaced within Colombia, I think, between 2 and 3 million people.
Four decades, 40 years of near continuous fighting. What kind of conditions are these internal refugees living in?
They miss a lot of things, and it's not only material needs. They need protection. They're complaining about the fact that they are not having any social services, education, health, not even state presence because of the fighting going on. I can compare easily to one of the worst situations in the sub-Saharan Africa.
So these are people who are living with hunger and illness in ramshackle housing, and many of them for a long time, right?
Exactly. And sometimes they are not even allowed to leave to seek security and protection somewhere else. Not only they cannot get the assistance they need, but not even the possibility of leaving to another area. What we need today is a global approach for this problem, both inside Colombia and, as I mentioned, in the neighboring countries. It's very difficult today to say how much is needed. I hope that in a few weeks' time we will be able to come out with something global which could be presented to the international community.
Yet if unity is needed, we read in Brussels, Colombian President Alvaro Uribe, a dozen European lawmakers walked out of a speech he gave to protest the Colombian president's new tougher military tactics against the rebels.
We know very well that President Uribe has been elected with the objective to fight the armed groups. The problem for us as a humanitarian is whatever decision is taken, whatever attitude is taken by the parties to this conflict, what is important is the free access to the victims everywhere. And this is our request to the government, to the armed groups, to the paramilitary, to everybody.
40 years of fighting, the Colombian government only cracking down, the guerrillas relentlessly at war. Is there any prospect for change in Colombia?
We do hope that at the end a solution will be found to the conflict. This is obvious. This is our wish. But what is important for us is to continue the support for these people, to continue the advocacy in coordination with everybody. And let me say that one thing makes me a little bit optimistic is the commitment I have found in Colombia by the civil society there.
How do Colombians feel about it? How aware are Colombians, particularly in the still wealthy upper class, of the crisis of as many as 3 million of their countrymen and women living in these conditions?
My impression is maybe they are not totally aware of what's happening outside the big cities and outside Bogota in particular.
Mr. Morjane, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Kamal Morjane is Assistant UN High Commissioner for Refugees. He joined us from Geneva.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The golden retirement nest eggs of many older Americans seem to be cracking. The elderly are borrowing on their credit cards more than ever before, according to a new study. resulting in average monthly balances of almost $6,000. Retiring in the Red, the Growth of Debt Among Older Americans, is the title of the new study. It was conducted by Demos, a New York public policy group. Tamara Drought is co-author of the study. She joins us from New York. And Tamara, the first line in your study says that the average credit card debt among seniors increased by 89% between 1992 and 2001. Wow. What's driving seniors into debt?
Well, I think what we're finding is that millions of older Americans are facing economic insecurity due to a couple of things: rising health and housing costs and decline in assets. You know, when we think of retirement security, we think of the three-legged stool: Social Security supplemented by pensions and personal wealth. Well, what we find is that two of these legs have been weakened. People have less personal wealth and less pension money, and credit cards are really replacing those two legs of the stool.
Mm-hmm. Your study also found a sharp increase in the number of seniors experiencing something called debt hardship. What is that?
What we found is about one in five middle-to-low-income seniors now spend over 40% of their income servicing their debts.
Jeez. Tamara, what are a couple of things that can be done about this, if anything? Does the economy just have to change, or is there public policy that can change the situation?
Well, I think first we need to help seniors get out of debt. And one of the easy ways we can do that is just to lower the cost of credit for them. You know, right now we're in historic lows in interest rates, but what we're finding in credit cards is they're just not coming down. Seniors are paying anywhere on average from 16% up to 29%. And so we need to pass on some rate relief to...
You mean give seniors a break like they get at the movie theater or getting on the subway?
Well, I think we should give all Americans a break, because what we've found in our first study is that this is a problem that is affecting all sectors of the population. It just doesn't make any sense that people are spending 20% in interest on these debts.
Yeah. How would you go about that?
Well, I think first, you know, one of the things we found is that there's still a lot of misperception about the problem of debt. And I think that when we look at older Americans, it sort of cuts right to the heart of this myth, which is, when we think of seniors, we think of people who have decades of financial experience, who grew up with more of an ethos of thrift than, say, later generations. And yet they're not immune to what we call the decade of debt. They are turning to credit cards to meet the cost of prescription drugs, to deal with rising housing costs, to deal with declining assets. And that's what all of us are doing. Many people are turning to credit cards as a way to make ends meet. So I think first we need to really realize that debt has become an economic security issue in this country, and that we need to take it seriously and put aside the myths that this is about, you know, frivolous consumption and rampant materialism, that this is really an indicator of how people are doing in our economy.
Expands well beyond just seniors. Tamara Drought, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Tamara Drought is co-author of the new study, Retiring in the Red. To read the study, check out our website, here-now.org.
Consider the poor pasta. In the late 80s, some diet gurus said, eat as much as you want and lose weight. Now the Atkins diet says, no pasta in the induction phase. The South Beach diet says, restrict all refined carbohydrates such as pasta. Pasta has become the forbidden fruit. Here in Our Food Guru, Scott Haas wondered, what's so bad about pasta? And decided to pose that question to Chef Jody Adams of Rialto's in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Dr. Frank Sachs, lead researcher on a government study of diet and obesity.
I don't agree that pasta is bad. Pasta got a bad name, if it really has a bad name, which I've never heard that it has a bad name.
Well, I'm thinking only as a bad name because I know people intimately who are on the Atkins diet who they look at pasta the way people on diets used to look at chocolate. They fear it.
Hmm. Well, you know, even chocolate may be rehabilitated in the near future, but that's but that's another story.
All right.
Now, as far as pasta is concerned, pasta is carbohydrate. And in diets like Atkins, they are into low carbs, and instead they're into high fat and high protein. Now, it may be that, you know, too many carbs are bad for us, and I think that is true, that a very high carb diet is bad, in particular because the carbs we eat are often highly processed carbohydrates like white bread or in pastries or in colas, for example. And those carbs get absorbed very, very fast into the bloodstream.
And what does that mean when you say they get very absorbed very fast into the bloodstream? What's the effect in terms of weight gain or weight loss?
We would rather have the carbohydrate get digested slowly. For example, in a whole cereal grain, the carbohydrate gets digested slowly. And then it puts glucose or sugar into the blood in a very slow, controlled way. And then the body's metabolic response, that is more normal or natural to the body. So now, where does pasta get into this?
Right.
Okay, pasta is obviously a highly processed cereal grain.
Right.
But the processing compresses the grain or the starch so that it isn't digested so fast. It's not digested like white bread. So pasta is really a pretty decent form of carb.
But if you eat pasta, are you going to lose weight?
Well, it all depends what your total diet is. You see, I mean, a nutrient is a nutrient. And, people lose weight on a high-carb diet, and people can lose weight on a low-carb diet. The question is that the only diet you can lose weight on? Our research says, no, you can lose weight on a lower carb, but not ridiculously low, say on an Atkins diet, a lower carb diet where the carb is good and that there are many other healthy foods along with it. Now, what I like about pasta, in addition to the carb being, slowly absorbed, is that it's a great vehicle for other very healthy things like olive oil, which is a good fat, like vegetables, tomato sauce. Do you eat a bowl of tomato sauce by itself? Well, tomato sauce is good for us.
Getting over to pasta, Jody, have you noticed you serve pasta here at the restaurant, right?
Yes, we do serve pasta.
And have you noticed any decline in people buying pasta since this Atkins craze took over about a year ago?
Absolutely not. Pasta is one of those things that wherever you put it on the menu, it sells. It's always one of the top sellers. Anecdotally, from my perspective, it's all about balance. And portion size is hugely important. Americans are terrified of ever being hungry. And in fact, being hungry is part of a healthy day. You should be hungry for a meal. You should wait between meals. And, pasta is not the place to go in terms of figuring out why Americans are so fat.
I had been told that one of the things that we would be doing today is actually tasting some pasta. Is that going to happen?
Yes. And actually what I did, which is really the way I think the best way to approach pasta, is start with whatever pasta it is you have and then figure out what it is you have either in the refrigerator or in the market that works best. So I chose to make a pappardelle, which is one of my favorite pastas. It's a big, fat, wide noodle, pappardelle, like a ribbon. And serve it. When you have a big pasta like that, you can serve it with bigger vegetables and bigger pieces of things. So it's going to be with slow-braised baby tomatoes in olive oil, shiitake mushrooms, arugula, and a little bit of duck.
That sounds wonderful. So can we go in the kitchen and do that?
Absolutely.
I'm going to follow you. Oh, cool. It's on fire. I thought they only did that in open kitchens to impress the guests. That's a real thing?
Why does that go on fire?
That's moisture going into a hot pan.
Well, I have to say that it tastes very home-cooked. There's a real cozy flavor to the roast duck. It's not a huge portion. It's just about right.
I think so. It's modest and very satisfying and very healthy.
Well, I'm almost at the point now where, to be perfectly honest, I don't really care if it's healthy or not because it's just so delicious. It's worth the sacrifice. But in addition to the fact that it's delicious, it is healthy, huh?
Right. They're not incompatible.
Here are now food guru Scott Haas with Chef Jody Adams and Dr. Frank Sachs of Harvard University School of Public Health. By the way, Scott's new book, Are We There Yet? Perfect Family Vacations and Other Fantasies, is due on bookstore shelves next week.
I remember pasta. Now I'm not anti-pasta. It always did the trick.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
But it became a habit that was hard to lick. Oh, yes, and I remember Fannie Mae, but from where...
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.